Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church. On the web at ignatius.com.
From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Today on Register Radio, Tim Drake talks with our Rome correspondent, Edward Penton, about Rome's very first March for Life. In the second half of the program, we'll be talking with Register correspondent Charlotte Hayes about this new document you may have heard of, Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. What's that all about? We're going to find out today here on Register Radio, a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Tim Drake, senior writer for The Register. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Tom. It's good to be with you.
And you, my friend. It's always a pleasure to bring Edward Penton on the program, our Rome correspondent who handles really everything happening out of the Eternal City for us.
That's right. We brought Edward on here today to talk to us about the March for Life, which took place in Rome on May 13th. More than 150 organizations banded together to host Rome's inaugural March for Life. Edward, thank you so much for joining us again on Register Radio.
Good to be with you guys. Thanks.
So first of all, let's talk a little bit about the March for Life in Rome. Can you tell us what was the inspiration or what were the reasons for this inaugural march in Rome?
Strangely, Italy has only had one other March for Life, and this is the first ever March for Life in Rome. And the organizers have been wanting to do one for many years because they were inspired by the March for Life that takes place every year in Washington. But they were hindered by it for various reasons, one of which was that the main organization, Movimenti per la Vita, Movement for Life, actually didn't agree with having a march for many years. The president didn't, at least. So there was that obstacle which they had to overcome. But in the end, they just took it upon themselves to organize it through these 150 organizations, pro-life organizations, and managed to get it going, the first one, as I said, in Rome this year. So that's basically the background to it. I mean, obviously, quite a few people have been wanting to have this for a while, but now they've actually managed to do it.
And how long has abortion been legalized in Italy?
It was legalized in 1978, a law called Article 194, and it was done through a referendum, I believe. So that's been going for quite a few years now. And it's quite liberal. It allows abortions up to 12 weeks for seems to be any reason, really. And 5 million are supposed to have been killed since that law took effect in 1978.
So tell us a little bit more about the march. What was the route of the march, and how many people participated in it?
Started at the Colosseum, and then went through the main part of Rome, and up to Piazza Venezia. If you know Rome, you'll know these sites. But essentially, if you don't know it, it goes through the historical part of Rome, from the Colosseum to Piazza Venezia, up to Corso Vittorio Emanuele, up to Castel Sant'Angelo, which is the castle where the popes used to seek refuge, and then up to the Vatican. If you were to walk it, it would take you about half an hour. And as the march obviously went much slower than that, but it took about a few hours from 9:30 in the morning and finished there at midday when they celebrated Mass in St. Peter's Basilica.
Any idea on the participant size? How many people showed up?
Yes, the organizers estimate there were 15,000 there. Some estimated fewer, but it was a pretty good crowd. And of course, what was good about the crowd was that it was from all over the world. I mean, you had lots of people from the United States, lots of marchers from European countries, and then you had also people from Italy. At least there were lots from northern Italy, and then quite a few from southern Italy, but the most came from the north of the country.
one thing in this country, in the United States, is kind of a pet peeve among a lot of us, is that the mainstream media just does not cover the March for Life that we have in Washington, D.C., even though it's been going on for many, many years now. How was the coverage by the other newspapers? I'm assuming that L'Osservatore Romano covered it, but well, what about the others?
That's a good point. Actually, to be honest, I didn't actually see much of coverage after it. There may have been, but I didn't actually come across much.
Mm-hmm.
I do know, I'm aware of what happened in the United States, but I do think there was quite a bit of coverage, although I think there was a problem in trying to get the message out beforehand.
Mm.
Lots of people said they weren't aware it was going to take place. People saw a few fly posters on the billboards around the city, but not much else. That could have probably been handled better. And certainly they hope to get more people next year.
This is something that they are planning to host annually?
It is, Tim, yeah. They're going to probably, they've already fixed the date for next year, which will be May the 12th. Yes, they hope to have it annually after that.
Was there a significance to the date that they chose, Edward? Of course, in the U.S. here, it was Mother's Day, but I was just wondering if there was any significance to the date there in Italy.
Yes, well, it was. I mean, it was also Our Lady of Fatima that day, and coinciding with Mother's Day in Italy as well. So it was a very poignant and fitting day to have it. Unfortunately, it won't be the same next year, but it was good that the first ever March for Life in Rome took place on a day which really was very fitting.
And so give us an idea now, I don't know, in terms of demonstrations in Italy, is 15,000, is that a good number for a demonstration, a public demonstration in Rome?
Pretty small, to be honest, for comparison. I don't know if you know, but in Italy they do like to take to the streets to protest.
Yes.
I mean, that's another fact that makes this March for Life rather unusual, that it hasn't been staged until now, because they do like to get out there and with banners and really make their point. And often they can be huge crowds, you know, 30, 40,000. So it was perhaps on the small side, but won't be difficult, I should think, to get more support in the years ahead for this march.
Why did it take so long for a march like this? Were there certain people who were advocating not taking this approach?
There were. I mean, I spoke to the one who really pushed it, an activist called Virginia Coda Nunziante. She said year after year they've been wanting to have certain pro-life activists have been wanting to have a march in Italy. But she said the Movement for Life that I mentioned just a moment ago, which is a federation of 600 local pro-life groups, the president of that group never wanted a March for Life. She said it was because he thought it wasn't necessary for Italians to demonstrate in such a way, and it wasn't an Italian thing to do, which is very unusual. But that's apparently what he said. Coda Nunziante and these other 150 organizations just decided in that case to take it upon themselves and organize it themselves, which actually was a very important point, because coming up from the grassroots makes it even more effective. This is their argument, that because it's not coming from top down, from the Vatican, from the Italian bishops, or from the Movement for Life, because it's coming from the people up, it actually gives it a lot more weight. They believe it has more potential to change public opinion in that sense.
I'd be curious to know the composition of those those who attended, because as we see here in the U.S. for the annual March for Life in Washington, you know, it is predominantly young people and young adults. Did you see the same thing at the march in Rome?
That's true. That was a very visible aspect of this march, was that there were lots of young people here. And actually, it was something which Cardinal Raymond Burke, who was taking part in the march, noticed as well. I couldn't give a figure on the proportion, but there were certainly many of them. And also, as I say, you got lots from other nationalities, also other religions. We had two Buddhist monks here. And then there was also a rape victim here, I believe. I didn't speak to her, but I believe that she was herself a child of a rape, but was always obviously grateful that she wasn't aborted. A whole wide variety of people, obviously not as diverse perhaps as in Washington, but certainly a good mix.
Were there speakers prior to the march? I believe I had read that that St. Gianna's daughter had spoken. Is that right?
That's right, she did. Yes, she spoke at the beginning of the march. Somebody called Dr. Javier Dor, who's president of a French organization called SOS Toutes Petites, which underlines the important role of fathers in choosing life. other speakers too. There were speeches read out of Pope John Paul II and Blessed Mother Teresa about pro-life issues, supporting the pro-life movement. And then you had Rome's mayor, Gianni Alamanno, who, despite protests from secularists, actually delivered a short speech and took part in the first segment of the march, admired by a lot of those who took part as well. The Rome's mayor is actually really quite pro-Catholic and has been very supportive of the church since he's been mayor for the past, I think, 4 or 5 years. So his contribution was much valued.
And then the last thing I wanted to ask, Edward, is I know that you spoke with Cardinal Raymond Burke and that he participated in the march, and I was just curious what he had to say about the event.
Well, I had a brief chat with him, and he was actually, there weren't many Vatican officials there. I think probably he was the only senior one there, because, again, it was coming from the grassroots. They didn't actually, in a sense, want too many from the hierarchy, because they wanted it to be from the people, as it were, from the laity. But he had some interesting things to say. I mean, he said, of course, that the march was very important because it's a fundamental witness to the inviolable dignity of human life and the responsibility that all of us have to restore the respect of the dignity of the human person in society. And then he said that Rome, being one of the most important cities in the world, makes it even more important. So that was underlined. And he also said it had great significance for Italy, but also the whole world for that reason. As I say, he noticed that there were many young people there. And he said, I asked him, you know, do you think the tide perhaps is turning in the pro-life movement? Do you think this is a sign that it's really changing? And he said, yes, he believed it was, and he believes it has been for some time. He said there's no question that the contrary forces, as he put it, hold a great so-called worldly power. But then he said that you have a force, which a profoundly spiritual force, which will eventually triumph and overcome the forces of the culture of death, was how he put it. So he was very hopeful, of course, and very optimistic. He was similarly surprised that it was the first March for Life in Rome. But he said, as others had said to me as well, that, you know, it's a surprise, but at least the first step has been taken, and it'll be the one of hopefully many more. He thought it would grow and grow and grow, was how he put it. And he said that, you know, despite the temptation to be discouraged, the other side seems to be winning, and often is winning on these issues. He said that these marches are very good at encouraging and bringing people together in the desire to see change. And he said that that's a very, very powerful witness. And that's why he's a big proponent of these kinds of manifestations.
Very good. Well, Edward, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us again on Register Radio. And we have to go to break. So thank you again.
Okay, thank you.
And when we return, we'll be talking with Register correspondent Charlotte Hayes about her recent articles on the dangers of this new document, Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. Sounds innocuous, but maybe not. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Stay with us.
Hello, I'm Michael Warsaw, Chief Executive of EWTN and publisher of the National Catholic Register. We're in a time in history like no other. In our fight for religious freedom and the need for the new evangelization, it's essential to stay connected via the faithful Catholic content delivered by the Register. We've finally been able to help realize Mother Angelica's dream. She always wanted a newspaper as part of EWTN's media apostolate. Why? Because there's an important catechetical opportunity at the intersection of faith and culture. Since the 1920s, the Register has been advancing the truth of the Magisterium. This valuable resource will help you to better understand the faith and deepen your relationship with our Lord. Join the growing ranks of Register subscribers today and access the one source of leading voices and opinions concerning the issues that matter most to you.
To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the Register subscription banner or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Tim Drake, I'm Tom Price. And Tim, we're delighted to bring on Register correspondent Charlotte Hayes to talk about this document with a very innocuous sounding title, Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment.
That's right. There are many threats to life, Tom, both at its beginning and at its end. And National Catholic Register correspondent Charlotte Hayes recently wrote an article titled Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment, Helpful or a New Threat? It takes a look at a medical directive that's been described as a living will on steroids. And to help us understand this order and what the concerns are, we're speaking with Charlotte. Charlotte, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Register Radio.
Well, thank you all so much for having me. I'm glad to talk about this because, as you said, the PULST has an innocuous-sounding name, but it's anything but innocuous. PULST stands for Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. Unfortunately, it tilts towards not having life-sustaining treatment. It's an end-of-life document. It's the latest one to develop. It's a brightly colored one-page document printed on both sides, and you check off some boxes regarding treatment. Do you want antibiotics? Do you want sustenance? Do you want nourishment? Do you want the full treatment? Well, the interesting thing is it really, really tilts towards non-treatment. The no's are up at the top. You start with, no, I don't want any antibiotics, and move down to, well, yeah, I want antibiotics. But the really bad thing is these are being presented to frail people in nursing homes. They have facilitators who are trained to go in and get them to sign. Ask them to sign. I make it sound more coercive. But when they're asked to sign, they're told things like, well, would you want CPR? You know, a lot of bones get broken when people have CPR. Sometimes there's brain damage. So the real tilt is towards not treating people. And you can get into a terribly dangerous situation. Let's say you're unconscious and simple antibiotics would bring you out. Well, if you've signed this document, you're in trouble. The other thing, we quoted Christian Brugger, who's an ethicist, moral theologian, and he, saying that it's a living will on steroids. It really is, because this is a physician's order. It's legal. Once it's signed by a doctor, it absolutely has to be carried out. So, and it's hard to revoke it. You can't just say, gee whiz, I've changed my mind. I'd like to live.
How does it then differ from a living will?
Well, it differs from a living will. A living will is something you sign and it says what you want. But a doctor can use a little bit of discretion on this. This is a legal doctor's order. Once you have signed this and the doctor signed it saying that you don't want treatment, it is a legal order. The people in the emergency room would have no room for discretion. They couldn't say, gee whiz, this person is really not in that bad of shape. And the PULST also follows you from hospital to this place to that place. Unless you revoke it, it's inescapable.
And who developed this directive?
Well, it was developed at a nonprofit in Oregon, a place that was developed in the 1990s at the Center for Ethics and Healthcare at the Oregon Health Science Institution. It's a foundation, and according to its website, it envisions healthcare that is compassionate, just, and respectful. And, you know, sometimes as much as compassion is a virtue, sometimes it's a code word, too.
So tell me, Charlotte, where is the PULST currently being used? Is this being used across the country?
No, it's standard operating procedure in a number of states, in Oregon, of course, in New York and Wisconsin, West Virginia, and a number of states. But here's the deal. States that don't have it are generally engaged right now in debating whether or not to have it. You have to set up some legislation before you can have it. You can't just come in and say, gee, we want to do this. Legislation is required, but there are many, many states that are doing it now. I think now is the time to start thinking about this, and if it's going on in your state, think about it now before the law's passed.
So let's talk a little bit more about what the potential dangers or concerns are with this document. As I understand it, you're making a decision about your care, and that decision could be being made for far into the future, way ahead of any kind of potential issue. And you are saying that you may not want hydration, you may not want food.
Let's say you're a healthy person and you're asked to sign this this post, you know, you're feeling pretty good, and they say, gee whiz, if you were in a terrible situation, would you want this, that, and the other, and you're feeling pretty good. And so you say, oh, gee whiz, I don't want to be a vegetable, and you sign it. Well, guess what? When you get sick and you're really confronting life or death issues and it's not in a vacuum, you may very well want to live and see the value of life. Basically, you make this difficult to revoke judgment at a time when the issues just don't seem relevant at all. It really should be called physician's order for not sustaining treatment. And it also offers options that in Catholic theology are just not acceptable. You know, the Pope has said, I think it was John Paul II, you cannot withhold nourishment, food and water, even if it's going to be artificially delivered. Well, if you sign a post, they can withhold it. That's one of the options.
You can make a choice. You're given choices about what kind of treatment you do
or do not want. There are just little boxes. As I said, it's all on one page. It seems very clear-cut. I want antibiotics, I want some antibiotics, I want no antibiotics, but I've done it in the wrong order. They start with the non-treatment at the very top. And I think there's probably an attempt to go in and get people to say, you know, do you want to really end up in bad shape? If they do CPR on you, it's going to break your ribs. That actually is something facilitators are taught to say, according to people I talk to. And I think, you know, people will think, gee, I don't want to be a burden to my family. So they'll sign these. And then, you know, when they actually come into play, there's really nothing you can do about it because it's a doctor's order. And no other doctor, the emergency room people can't say, gee whiz, she's changed her mind. It's a doctor's order. You can't evade it. It goes with you until you revoke it, which is not easy.
You're listening to Register Radio. I am Tim Drake, and we are speaking with National Catholic Register correspondent Charlotte Hayes about her recent article about physician's order for life-sustaining treatment. Charlotte, who is it that is that's pushing for this document? I know some of the organizations are not real pro-life organizations,
well,
certainly.
Well, yeah. Do you remember the Hemlock Society?
Yes.
It was the euthanasia group. They've changed their name, but they're pushing for this. And I think just, you know, that they're called Compassion and Choices now. Compassion and Choices was founded by a merger of the Hemlock Society and another euthanasia group. And on its website, it says the POST is considered the strongest, most explicit form of patient-directive care. And, you know, I talked to Rita Marca, who's a wonderful crusader for all the right things. And she said, you know, there are many good people behind POST, but you've got to look at who's pushing for it. And who's pushing for it is organizations like Compassion and Choices. It's the euthanasia organization. So look, this is not about sustaining life, really. If it were, I'd be all for it. It's interesting, even now in our society, the presumption is towards treating people. If you're in a bad way, the doctor's going to make the presumption to treat you. What POST really does is gives him the right to make the presumption not to treat you. John Berhaney, who's head of the Catholic Medical Association, said, you know, what a living will or POST can do is absolve the doctor of the legal liability of treating you. And so you go into the emergency room, you're really sick, you've signed this document, and so you don't get treatment. Let's say you signed it when you were 60, you were healthy, and you were asked, do you want to be hooked up to a lot of machines? And you think, gee whiz, I don't. That would be terrible. But now you're 75, and you're going through a rough patch that's temporary, or would be temporary if you hadn't signed a POST, and there's just nothing the emergency room staff can do because you've signed this, a doctor signed it, and it's an order.
Well, in light of that, I want to ask one final question, Charlotte. And what is it that you would recommend that patients and their families do in light of this?
I talked to Christian Brueger again, who's just such a great moral theologian. And what he says is you need somebody to have power of attorney to make decisions for you and to make decisions that are in accord with Catholic teaching. And what he says, if you don't have anybody in your family, ask your parish priest. Of course, he works in a seminary, and he said he always tells people who are studying to be priests in the Denver Archdiocese that whatever burdens you have, you should make yourself available to perform this service. And I would say find somebody you trust who understands Catholic teaching, or go to your parish priest and say, hey, I'm giving you power of attorney to make this decision if I'm ever incapacitated. And that way, unlike the post where you're checking off boxes years before you may need to make these decisions, you have someone who has a Catholic grounding who's there to make the decision, and the decision based on your real medical needs. Real medical needs cannot be decided on the basis of a few boxes to check off, talking to a facilitator who is not a physician, maybe a social worker. So ask your parish priest if you don't have anybody to help you with this.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Register Radio today, Charlotte.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I met Tim one time in Birmingham, and it was a pleasure.
My thanks as well, Charlotte. As a reminder, on this Memorial Day weekend, EWTN Television and Radio will broadcast a Memorial Mass in honor of Memorial Day, and that'll be celebrated by Archbishop Timothy Broglio of the Archdiocese for the Military, and it's coming up Monday, noon Eastern, on most of these EWTN stations. Hey, Tim, have a great long weekend. We'll talk again next week.
Yes, you too, Tom.
Thank you for joining us this time on Register Radio. For all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church. On the web at ignatius.com.